Champaign Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Severance Reed Architects, Designers, and Planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for higher education, lifestyle, and cultural clients. On the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. The Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois has invited a senior curator in the Department of Greek and Roman Antiquities at the British Museum to campus for the annual Campbell Lecture in the Dr. Alan C. Campbell Family Distinguished Speaker Series. Dr. Ian Jenkins will speak at the Spurlock Museum Night Auditorium this evening at 7 o'clock. The public is invited to attend. Admission is free. Dr. Jenkins's talk is titled Return to Knidus, Digging in Southwest Turkey. Knidus was one of the first excavations of the British Museum. The museum excavated the site of this ancient city in the 19th century. The city had been home to a famous medical school and the site of the observatory of the astronomer Eudoxus. We'll hear more about the ancient city of Knidus as Dr. Jenkins is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Dr. Jenkins is the author or co-author of many books and articles. His books include Greek and Roman Life, The Parthenon Frieze, and with Kim Sloan, Vases and Volcanoes. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Ian Jenkins, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
One of the first excavations of the British Museum. Why don't you tell us to begin here this afternoon a little something of the museum's history?
The British Museum is the oldest public museum in the world. It was founded in 1752 to house the collections of Sir Hans Sloane, who was a great collector and physician to George III. And he left to the nation his house museum, and the government adopted his proposal that it should be converted into a public museum, and it was transferred then to Old Montague House, a Palladian mansion that stood where the current British Museum stands in Bloomsbury. It was primarily a museum of books, manuscripts and natural history, and although Sloane had a few antiquities, they were not the main strength of his interest. He was a doctor, so he was interested in specimens of natural history and the natural sciences, natural philosophy, as they called it in the Enlightenment culture of the day. And gradually, the museum has evicted the natural history and more recently the books and manuscripts, each of which have gone on to found new national institutions of their own, the Natural History Museum in South Kensington, the British Library close to now St Pancras Station, and has evolved into what we now know it as a great museum of art and antiquity.
When did the museum, its interest veer into the realm of antiquities?
Well, one of the pioneer collectors who saw the opportunities that the museum had to be a showpiece of man-made art was Sir William Hamilton. And you mentioned the book I published with Kim Sloan, Vases and Volcanoes. That was an exhibition catalogue to accompany a show we did in 1996, setting out the life and times, collections and interests of Sir William Hamilton, who was 40 years British ambassador in Naples and took the opportunity there to collect many of the finds that were coming out of the ground in early excavations around the Bay of Naples, among the cities that had been buried in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in AD 79. And it was through the purchase of Sir William Hamilton's collection in 1772, his first great collection, that the museum began to have a presence on the stage of art and artifact. Then, of course, the great incentive, the great goad, if you like, to becoming what it is today was competition with the French. Napoleon's armies had invaded Europe in the 1790s and had made of the Louvre a great trophy of conquest, a showpiece of French art and cultured interests. And in 1802, British travellers took advantage of a temporary peace, the Peace of Amiens, to scuttle across the channel between Britain and France to go and see this new museum. And they were shocked by what an impression it made on the eye, and resolved to collect as much classical antiquity, sculpture in particular, as they could. And the first collection of sculpture to come to the museum was that of Charles Townley, who bequeathed his collection in 1805. And then the great treasures rolled in. In 1814, the sculpture from the Temple of Apollo Epicurus at Bassy, there's a cast of one of the frieze blocks in the Spurlock Museum. In 1816, the museum acquired the Elgin marbles. And in the 1820s, great collections of Egyptian sculpture came in. In the 1840s, Layard went to Iraq and discovered the ancient civilizations of Nineveh and Nimrud, and excavated there and brought massive Assyrian sculptures memorably to England. And so it went on until in the 1850s, Charles Newton went to the Eastern Aegean, and there he was intent primarily on discovering the mausoleum of Halicarnassus, which he succeeded in doing, and brought yet more great classical sculpture to the British Museum.
Now, Charles Newton, was he... He's a pioneer in field archaeology, this much I know. And I was curious about, with his coming to the museum, is that when the museum itself begins expeditions and begins its surveys and its excavations?
That's a very interesting question. The museum actually didn't actively excavate itself until quite late in the 19th century. The museum tended to support and encourage people acting on its behalf. So, for example, Sir Charles Fellowes went to Lycia in 1842 and again in 1844 and excavated the civilization that we know now as Lycia in southwest Turkey. But he wasn't an employee of the British Museum. He was a gentleman of independent means, the son of a wealthy businessman. Charles Newton, on the other hand, had been an employee of the British Museum since the 1840s, had been a junior assistant in what was then called the Department of Antiquities, but actually left the museum in 1852 to take up a diplomatic post in the Eastern Aegean, and thus acquired the freedom and the necessary political leverage to conduct excavations on behalf of the British Museum. He then, at the end of his great period of excavation and exploration, in 1860 came back to the British Museum to be the first keeper of the newly formed Department of Greek and Roman Antiquities. And it was from that point on that the British Museum took what I think we would now recognize as a modern scientific approach to the field of archaeology.
Very interesting. We have a listener waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Our guest today, Dr. Ian Jenkins. He is a senior curator in the Department of Greek and Roman Antiquities at the British Museum, and he is in Champaign-Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois for the annual Campbell Lecture in the Dr. Alan C. Campbell Family Distinguished Speaker Series, which will be held this evening at the Spurlock Museum at 7 p.m. this evening. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join the discussion. I invite your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. This is one of those times where, in some sense, I'd rather just sit back and listen to him talk. Certainly brings back memories of going through old large books that showed photographs of things in the British Museum and various libraries as a child. But I do have two questions. One, I don't know how controversial it is now. I've lost contact. But at one time there were, I guess especially with those marbles, that there's countries or what have you would like to have some of those things back that the British took. I'm wondering where that situation is right now, or even if it is a situation, if it's all over with now, then fine. My second question deals with, I just recently read a book, it's from the 30s, Theodore Fife, I think, architect in Britain, wrote on Hellenistic architecture. I was wondering if you could give some overview of what you have of Hellenistic architecture at the British Museum. Do you have some important pieces, that sort of information, something like that? Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the questions.
Yes, I suppose the most controversial possession of the British Museum is the Elgin Marbles. I like to think of them as the sculptures of the Parthenon, and these days I prefer to work on the sculptures of the Parthenon rather than on the Elgin Marbles, although I have written on the issue. They will always be controversial. They were controversial when they first came to the museum. They were controversial before they came to the museum. You remember the poet Lord Byron savagely attacking Lord Elgin for having removed them in the first place. And it's a situation which will never go away. It's not a situation, though, which is peculiar to the British Museum. If you're going to be a world museum, and I have the great pleasure to be visiting a world museum here in Illinois, the Spurlock Museum, you're bound to have in your museum collections that represent the world. We in the British Museum endeavour to share those collections with the world to make sure that they're properly exhibited and to share our knowledge with people from all over the world that come and visit us. We are a centre, a great magnet for many people who don't have the opportunity in their own country to see the sorts of things that can be gathered in the British Museum. And we like to think that we can tell a different story from the story that is told about Greek culture in Greece, where you can compare one Greek artefact with another. In the British Museum, you can compare Greek artefacts with those made in ancient Assyria, in Iran, and even make comparisons across time and place, looking between the ancient and the modern world. So I'm not going to beat around the bush with you and pretend that this isn't an issue. Of course it's an issue, and we must respect our Greek friends and colleagues' point of view, but we have a different point of view, and our job in the British Museum is to explain how we feel and to make sure that people understand both our vision and the collections that we're privileged to exhibit. Your other question was about Hellenistic architecture, and it's a timely question because I've just written a book, which is in manuscript, about the great monuments that we have represented in the museum as buildings. It's called Greek Architecture and Its Sculpture, and I try to navigate the reader from archaic Ephesus down to the late 4th century BC to the Temple of Athena Polias at Priene, and tell the story of the collections of architecture and the sculpture from those buildings in the British Museum as one story, as a great human endeavour. The Greeks were intensely aware of their own past, and there's this double dynamic in Greek architecture. On the one hand, they were hugely inventive. Around 600, 550 BC, they invented the orders, the Doric order and the Ionic order that we take for granted today. Many neoclassical buildings in America are inspired by the ancient buildings. One has to just walk around the mall in Washington to see the impact that Greece has made on the modern world. They invented these orders, but at the same time, they constantly looked back over their shoulders to see how others before them had done things. And that's the story which I try to set out in this book, and in so doing to also summarise for readers like you, intelligent and from what I hear, extremely informed reader, what there is in the museum, so that we can again share our inheritance from the 19th century with a worldwide readership.
Let's talk with another listener on campus. Make that in Urbana, excuse me, on line one. Caller in Urbana, good afternoon.
Hi, I didn't hear the very beginning of the program, but in regard to the last caller, my recollection is that the Parthenon at some point was even used for target practice. I don't know whether that was before or after the marbles were removed to England. But my dim recollection is that by removing them, you may have saved them from destruction. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, that however you view Lord Elgin's actions, his appropriation of the marbles was an act of rescue. It was the first act of conservation. That doesn't vindicate his actions in some people's minds, but it's a fact which sits in the landscape and in the ethical landscape, and we have to take account of it. I think just to broaden your point about the Parthenon being a object of target practice, it's important to remember that the Parthenon has not stayed still. It's changed over time. It began as a pagan temple. A fire wrecked its interior before the Roman period was out. It was converted into a church around AD 500. It was converted into a mosque around AD 1500. It was blown up in 1687. A mosque was built in the middle of it. Subsequently, it was pillaged by souvenir hunters. And when Lord Elgin came on the scene, he found that already in the 50 years since another set of travellers had published a large folio volume illustrating the sculptures that they had seen on the building in around 1750, much of what they had recorded had disappeared. For example, in the Spurlock Museum, there is a set of casts of the Parthenon frieze, a very important and rare set of casts, which ultimately derive from those made for Lord Elgin. And there is one panel which shows four figures who now simply don't survive. This image goes back to a cast made for the French ambassador, the Comte de Choiseul-Gouffier, in 1787. And that's the sort of damage that Lord Elgin feared would be continued if he didn't do what he did. And we are the richer for it.
We lived in Nepal for a while, and one of the problems there was pilfering of religious sculptures from the outdoor shrines. They don't have churches that are lockable. Well, they do have some, but a lot of the sculptures and shrines are outdoors or readily accessible and not easily locked up. And you just see all these empty spaces in a lot of places where things have been ripped off and sold to people. And part of me says I wonder if that's going to prevent them from being destroyed, or whether it's also yanking them out of the context in which they existed. It's a complex.
Context is a very complex issue. One can always argue that changing the location of an object decontextualizes it. So a picture designed to be hung on the wall of a fashionable salon in Paris now sits on the wall in a gallery in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. That's taking it away from its original context. But on the other hand, it's giving it a new context. It's created an art exhibit in a museum in America. Who's to say that in 1,000 years' time, the Metropolitan Museum of Art will exist and the object will still be there, or perhaps somewhere else, in which case it will acquire a new context. So objects like the Parthenon are not static. They change with the times, and different readings of these objects depend upon where we view them.
Well, it certainly is good that it's possible now to make some really good copies of things and to share their beauty around so that more people can see, have some idea of what the originals look like. Thanks very much. I'm looking forward to listening to the rest of the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener on campus on line 2. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I just have two questions. One is having to do with a news article about some facial cream found in Britain recently. I don't know if it happened while you were gone or not, but they didn't mention what year that would have gone back to, that Roman facial cream. Do you happen to know?
I don't, but I know that the Romans used powdered lead to whiten their faces, and this is thought to have contributed hugely to the shortening of people's lives in the ancient world. And I didn't see the news item that you referred to, but I wonder if that's what is at the back of it.
Yeah, they said something about it being in a container, and they were able to reproduce the compound, and it contained tin, and so they thought that even back then they realized that lead was dangerous.
Right, well, there we are. I can't recommend it to any listeners.
No. And my other question is, and I'll hang up and listen, is I read recently that, or heard recently, that a lot of large museums have issues about reducing duplicates and, somehow finding a way to reduce the amount of stuff they have in their basements and such, and in storage. And I was just curious if the British Museum has faced that kind of issue, and I was kind of hoping they might have a rummage sale once in a while. And you can tell me about that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Yeah, there was a cross-museum discussion paper that was published under the title "Too Much Stuff?" Of course, the British Museum, has no policy of deacquisition. We're not allowed to deaccess the objects by the trust placed in us by Parliament. There is one very carefully circumscribed exception, though. In theory, you could have two coins stamped from the same die, and in theory, the Department of Numismatics is at liberty to dispense with an inferior issue in favour of a better one. Similarly, there is, in theory, an argument for deaccessing prints from the same copper plate. But actually, if you talk to the curators concerned, they will say that there is no such thing as a duplicate, and that it would be silly to even go down the road of contemplating getting rid of different impressions, because they all have their own personality and carry their own story. So while some museums do go in for this, it's very much anathema to the British Museum's principles of holding all objects that it has acquired and registered in perpetuity.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Chicago, line four.
Sound like that.
Line four?
Do it over here. Do it over here.
We'll let that caller get himself ready to talk with us, and we'll, in the meantime, talk with a listener in Urbana. Line one, go ahead.
Yes. We teach courses at the university in the Library and Information Science Department on conservation and preservation. And one of the things that we do try to cover a little bit is museum conservation. And we would just be interested in knowing how many conservators you have and the types of work that they do. And that's pretty general question, but
yeah.
Interested.
I think the British Museum was the first to develop a dedicated museum conservation laboratory. A man called Harold Plenderleith is something of a legend in the world of conservation science and wrote one of the first books on the subject. There is one scientific research and conservation department, but it has many aspects to it. So there is a section for paper conservation that looks after the prints and the drawings and archival photographs. There's a metal conservation unit, there is a stone conservation unit, and there is an organics conservation unit. And, of course, it's a delicate balancing act between trying to maintain the collections in storage and presenting the objects on exhibition and providing the highest quality conservation for an object that is to travel as an exhibit for loan to a foreign museum. And there are never enough people or hours in the day to do all of what is required. And I'm sure you yourself know better than I do that there is no such thing as cutting corners where conservation is concerned. and also the, an ever-increasing exactitude in standards of conservation. One could, for example, as a conservator, spend one's time just going to conferences and learning how to do conservation. But I'm sure many of the concerns that face you are the same as my colleagues in my own museum's conservation department.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now let's try for our listener in Chicago on line four. Good afternoon.
Thank you. This question is relative to the general vastness of the British Museum's collection. I had heard in the past that if one were to view every article that the museum has for just 30 seconds, a person could not view everything in their entire lifetime. Is that huge?
That is possible, but it depends on the objects. I mean, clearly, for example, one could spend a life looking at the collection of prints and drawings. There is an estimated 3 million works on paper in that department alone. There are many objects in the museum which would merit more than 30 seconds, and there are some which frankly, probably merit less. But I think your point is that the collections are vast and represent all interests to all people. And as an omnium gatherum, the museum has maintained its comprehensive ambition to say yes to any man-made artefact which it thinks now or in the future may be of interest.
Relative to the other person saying about a rummage sale, if they were to have one, the Getty Museum here in America, which has $100 million a year annual budget at their disposal, would certainly be available to acquire some of it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. If you'd like to talk with our guest this afternoon, Dr. Ian Jenkins, he is a senior curator in the Department of Greek and Roman Antiquities at the British Museum. And he's here on the campus of the University of Illinois to speak this evening at the Spurlock Museum. The title of his talk, Return to Knidus, Digging in Southwest Turkey. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Well, let's go back to Charles Newton and Knidus, which is located in what is now Turkey, Southwest Turkey. What led Newton to Knidus?
what led Newton to Cnidus was the Mausoleum at Halicarnassus. He had this lifetime ambition to rediscover the site of the mausoleum, which had been one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, and as the tomb of Mausolus, the king of Caria, who ruled between 370 and 352 BC. It was the mother of all great tombs. Our word mausoleum comes from Mausolus's tomb. It had survived up until the 16th century, but the Crusader Knights of St. John dismantled it to create the castle of St. Peter that now guards the entrance to the harbour of the modern town of Bodrum that stands on the ruins of ancient Halicarnassus. Newton succeeded in the first winter that he spent with his team of naval engineers and sappers digging in Halicarnassus in locating the site, and spent all of 1857 in excavating it. But eventually, the prices of the properties that he was buying up from the local Turkish population increased and became prohibitively expensive. And so he decided to give the thing a rest and up anchored and sailed away, rather like buying a Turkish carpet. You know, you sort of decide the bargaining has gone as far as it can before you walk out the shop and then come back. And it was Newton's intention to come back, but he diverted his attentions to Cnidus, which is half a day's sail to the south, and there pitched camp in wooden huts in a bitingly cold winter. It was a very cold winter in 1856-57, and there was snow, as he tells us, along the higher mountain ridges of Caria. And there he excavated in several places through 1857 to the summer of 1859. He excavated in the cemetery, which is vast at Cnidus. It runs east of the city and for 4 miles and has many fine monuments in it. And there he discovered, among other things, a 7.5-ton lion that had pitched from its perch atop a monumental tomb and lay undisturbed for best part of 2,000 years before rediscovered by his architect, Richard Pullen. He excavated in the sanctuary of Demeter and brought back to the British Museum a wonderful statue, a 4th-century Greek, 4th-century BC, that is, Greek original, marble cult statue, a very rare survival. She probably survived because the Christian population that smashed so much sculpture at Cnidus in late antiquity took her for a Madonna and preserved her for Christian imagery. All of these places had remained alive in the archaeological memory, but there were others that interested me that had not. They had become lost and forgotten and had disappeared from the archaeological memory. And it was therefore in 1997 that I went out with a one-week return ticket in search of the lost places of Newton's excavations.
1 week?
Yes, I had in mind just to locate, in particular, his so-called Sanctuary of the Muses, from which the British Museum acquired a number of sculptures. And I was cataloguing sculpture at the time, and so I was curious to know more about the places from which he had acquired them. But when I got to Cnidus, and as the guest of my good friends, Professor Ramazan Uzgun and his German wife, Christine Brunz-Uzgun, who were already excavating there, I found that the situation on the ground was pretty confusing, and it took me 3 days of searching with Newton's sketch plan in hand to locate the so-called Sanctuary of the Muses. And when I finally did, I realised why it had gotten forgotten. It had been converted into a little farm by the local peasant population, and all the walls that Newton had excavated and left behind had been taken up and smashed into rubble to create a goat pen and a herdsman's hut.
And what was it like when you came across, when you discovered that that's what happened? It was,
well,
it was not only forgotten, but it was in a sense buried, not. You know,
well, quite so. I mean, yeah. First of all, I was delighted place back on the archaeological landscape an important site that had previously become lost. And my Turkish colleagues were, of course, equally delighted because they were constructing a new map of the town and surveying the ancient buildings and the street plan. And here was this new temple suddenly delivered on their doorstep. And then, to my great surprise and ultimate delight, Ramazan Bey simply said, "Well, you can't see anything here. You better come back and dig it."
I don't know which was the better moment.
Well, they compete with each other.
Yeah.
Of course, I needed to think long and hard about work commitments, but somehow we put a program together, and I've just completed my sixth season of excavation at the site, joining the Turkish excavations each summer and spending up to a month re-excavating the places that Newton knew. I finished the Sanctuary of the Muses in summer 2003.
But it's interesting as well to realize that in an article that you wrote that really Newton's Sanctuary of the Muses was a misnomer.
Yes, Newton had good reason to think of it as a Sanctuary of the Muses because there was an inscription recording a dedication of a little statue to the Muses. One of the good reasons for going back and looking again at old excavations is that our view of what was found is often different from that projected by the previous excavators. And my three questions were, what was the true layout? What was the date of the foundation of this place and something of its life? And thirdly, what was its purpose? And I discovered that its layout was pretty much as Newton had given it, but was able to correct his plan and also to project an elevation so we have a much better sense of the building in three dimensions. I could date it to the beginning of the 3rd century BC by the style of the masonry and other evidence, including the pottery finds. I could also tell something of its life, its Roman phase, but also, more importantly, its Christian phase, for it had been converted in around AD 500 into a church. And finally, I was able to demonstrate that far from being primarily a sanctuary of the Muses, it was in fact a fountain house and a sanctuary of the nymphs. And the reason for its foundation in the first place was to provide access to water which issued from springs in the living rock. And one of the things that attracted me to the place in the first instance was the grottos that one could see exposed in the rock.
Hmm. When was this city first laid out, and how long did it thrive?
Mm.
Why was it abandoned?
Yeah, all good questions. The history of Cnidus goes back beyond the city that we know. Thucydides and Herodotus referred to an earlier city, which is probably to be located at the modern tourist resort of Dacha, halfway along the Cnidian Peninsula. Cnidus, as we now know it, classical Cnidus, was probably a recreation of the town around the middle of the 4th century BC, around 360-350, under the incentive provided by Mausolus, who was carving out a kingdom for himself in this corner of the Persian Empire as it was then, and all over Caria, his local province, he was encouraging villagers to come together and recreate their civic identity in new towns new planned cities with streets laid out at right angles. And this happened at Halicarnassus, it happened on Kos, the island of Kos nearby, it happened at Kaunas to the east, it happened at Priene to the north, and it happened at Knidos. And the city was terraced into the sloping acropolis that falls 1,000 feet to the sea, and harbours were created, and new temples were founded, and domestic quarters laid out. And the city flourished. It was a great centre of commerce. The Canadian Peninsula is fertile and rich in almonds and wine production. It was a great centre for the production of pottery. It was also a centre of tourism. Famously, the Canadians, around 360 BC, bought a female nude statue by Praxiteles, the great Athenian marble carver, and installed it at Knidos, and it became a great site of the ancient world to visit. And famously, in the 2nd century AD, Lucian, in his collection of writings known as the Amores, Anecdotes of Love, went with some friends, and they walked through the harbour district, and they bought little souvenirs, pornographic pottery, the kind of which we find and examples of which I should be showing tonight in my lecture. And they went up to the temple of Aphrodite, and one of them famously crept in and hid during public hours and got himself locked in and made love to the statue at night. Better leave it there, I think, Celeste.
Okay, we'll leave it there. That was a good tease, though, for your lecture. So why was it abandoned?
Well, anybody who sailed up that coast will rejoice in the fact that Knidos has maintained its sea views. It's surrounded by sea on three sides, whereas Priene, Miletus, Ephesus, cities to the north, Pergamum, have all lost their sea coast by the action of rivers, which bring alluvial silt down in the winter rains, and the sea has retreated. Knidos kept its sea because there are no local rivers, but of course this provided access to pirates. And over the years, the city became just too difficult to live in. Our first evidence of the sort of attack that must have been frequent is a number of inscriptions in Arabic, Umayyad Arabic script, left in the 7th century AD on the floor of one of the churches that the Christians had created out of a classical building. And although the population probably returned, it was never again the great city that it had been. And eventually it was abandoned until it was rediscovered in the 18th century by European travellers.
Very interesting. Well, I have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. It's a pleasure meeting you and speaking with you, and I'm glad we were able to take some calls this afternoon. I think our listeners enjoyed it as well.
Thank you.
Our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine has been Dr. Ian Jenkins. He will give a lecture this evening at the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois. The topic of his talk is titled Return to Knidos, Digging in Southwest Turkey. The talk will be held in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum at 7 p.m. this evening. Admission is free. The public is welcome. The museum is located at 600 South Gregory in Urbana. It's directly across the street to the east of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. That's the Spurlock Museum, and their phone number, 333-2360. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Jenkins, is a senior curator in the Department of Greek and Roman Antiquities at the British Museum. 10 minutes before 2 o'clock. Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Les. From the Chicago Board of Trade, two things in major play for the day. Up front, of course, in the soybean pit, soybean rust that was announced to be confirmed in the U.S. by USDA and APHIS yesterday. Teams are on the ground in Louisiana and Mississippi at this point. We talked with the headquarters in Louisiana about what's happening. 20 individuals have been dispersed through 14 what they called parishes or counties in Louisiana and one in Mississippi. Today, they are searching for more remnants of soybean rust. Those first plants that were infected were actually noticed in Louisiana State University research plots. So scientists are out feverishly today in 15 counties in that area, parishes, searching for more soybean rust. That's happening, and that's been having an impact, Chicago Board of Trade, at least yesterday, and to some impact today as well. And then, of course, the big factor will happen again tomorrow morning when the November crop production report is released at 7:30. Be sure to tune in at 8:49 a.m. That is when our first ag programming comes on the air. Dave Dickey will be here with all the details of the crop production report. One other note, if you want to see those crop production reports in your email, you can go to our webpage right now or sometime later this evening and sign up to get our ag newsletter. It's at www.will.uiuc.edu. A newsletter is sent out usually on weekends, every weekend, and then periodically when important things happen. For instance, when crop production report numbers come out, we send out those numbers directly to you. So if you're interested in those, go to the bottom of our ag webpage. There is a little button that says subscribe. It'll open an email automatically. Just send it to us, and we'll make sure you're on that list by tomorrow morning. Now, let's take a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade as they came out this afternoon in the wheat pit. The high in the December, 304.5. The low at 301. Settlement price at 302.75, down 0.75%. The March futures, 316.5 high, low at 312. Settlement price there, 314. And penny and 0.75 lower. May contract down 1.75 as well, at a high of 323.5, a low of 319, settled at 320.25. July futures ranged from 328 to 325, with its settlement price at 326. The harvest month for the wheat, at the hard red winter, rather soft red winter wheat, Chicago Board of Trade down 1.5 today. December corn futures now were off 1 cent today, 198.5 the high, the low at 197. That meets that current contract low in the December corn. Bounced just a bit off that at 197.25 for the settlement price, down 1 cent for the day. March futures, 210.25 high, low at 208.5, settlement price at 209.25, down 1. And the May futures, 217.5 high, low at 216. Settlement price at 216.25, a penny and a quarter lower. July futures, 224.25 high, low at 222. Settlement price at 222.5, down 1.5. And September futures, 231.5 the high, the low at 229.25. Settlement price at 229.5, down 2 cents. And December futures, 239.5 the high, the low at 237. And a settlement price at 237.25, down 3. It can be kind of interesting tomorrow morning at 7:30 a.m. when that crop production report comes out, especially with the December corn setting right there at 197.25. If it comes out a little bit bigger than what most traders expect, it'll be kind of interesting to see how the corn reacts and whether it can push on through and whether it'll drop down to 185 or further. We'll talk about that this afternoon, by the way, with Dan Zwicker at 6 after the next hour during the closing market report. December oats, 144.5, the high, the low at 141.75, settlement price at 143.75. That was up 1.5 for the day. In the March futures, 150 the high, the low at 148, settled up on that high at 150, 1.5 higher for the March oats. November beans now off 2.5 cents today. 529 the high, the low at 18, settled at 20.5, $5.20 a bushel. The final price for the November beans are down 2.5, and they go off the board tomorrow. January beans, 528 the high, the low at 518, settlement price at 519.75, down 5.25, looking to take the lead option tomorrow around noon. March beans down 7.75 for the day, 533.5 the high, the low at 524, settlement price at 525.75, down 7.75. And the May contract at 541 high, a dime lower than that for the low at 531, settled 532.25, down 7 cents for the May soybeans. July futures, 547.5 the high, the low at $5.38 a bushel, settled 539.5. They were off 7.25, and the August contract settled 5 41.5, down 5.5 cents, with a high at 48.5 and low down there at 41.5 at the settlement price. December bean meal, 153.70, the high, the low at 149.50, settled 149.90, they were off $4. And the January meal off $3.80, a 155 high, 151.30, the low, and a settlement price at 151.40. December bean oil now, $20.85, the high, the low at $20.39 a pound. Settlement price at $20.49, they were off 30 cents in the January. $20.93, the high, the low at $20.52, settled $20.62, down 29 cents. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
And it was a largely higher day today on the Mercantile Exchange. February pork bellies, however, finished lower. November feeders, 108.50 the high, 108.05 the low, the settlement 108.42.5, that up 22.5. January, 103.80 the high, 102.60 the low, 103.30 the settlement, that up 142.5. March, 99.75 the high, 98.50 the low, 99.15 the settlement, that up 70. December live cattle, 85.82.5 the high, 84.60 the low, the settlement 85.47.5, that up 182.5. February, 88.60 the high, the low 87.20, the settlement 88.55, that up 170. December lean hog, 74.75 the high, 73.20 the low, 74.47.5 the settlement, that up 57.5. February, 74.30 the high, 72.85 the low, finishing at 74.25, up 40. April, 71 even the high, 69.65 the low, 70.97.5 the settlement, that up 42.5. And May lean hog, 69.85 the high, 68.75 the low, finishing at 69.85, that up 37.5. And let's take a look now at that contract for pork bellies. February bellies, 101.60 the high today. The low, $100.25. The settlement, $100.62.5. That down 142.5. The Dow is up 92 points at 10,477. The NASDAQ up 24 at 2058. And the S&P 500 11 higher at 1174.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Pete Hayek from San Antonio, Texas writes, "Dear Dr. Science, whenever I get upset, I always read a science fact, and that cheers me up. Sometimes it's just the molecular weight of a familiar substance, or I'll play a memory game with the periodic table. No matter which science fact I choose, I always feel better when I'm done. Have you had this experience?"
No, I'm afraid I haven't. Many of us who have devoted our lives to the pursuit of knowledge gain a great deal of